ॐ असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्युर्मा अमृतंगमय ॐ शांति 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 लॉर्ड लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल लीड अस फ्रॉम इग्नोरेंस टू इल्यूमिनेशन Lead us from death to immortality. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all. Om Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chano Ramardhanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat So this is the last talk on the Bhagavad Gita. It's a vast scripture consisting of 18 chapters and almost 700 verses. Before we conclude this last talk, we must try to assess the greatness or the importance of an incarnation. One of the greatest beliefs among Hindus is that whenever dharma declines and adharma increases, God, out of his infinite compassion, incarnates himself as a human being and sets the balance right. And this had what saved Hinduism from extinction. In a real sense of the word, no religion can be extinguished, but it can become a kind of dead tree. So if And a nice analogy for this would be, if you are growing a rose bush, it needs to be pruned and it needs to be strengthened. And this is what exactly an incarnation does. And to appreciate the real significance of an incarnation, two things are necessary. One must have a great intuitive understanding and a long time, passage of time. Because we cannot judge the value of any, the work of an incarnation in a short time. And notoriously in these modern times, we try to judge a thing by instantaneous results, which is counterproductive in many ways. When I say counterproductive, I will give an example. Nowadays, people are not looking for long-term happiness. They are looking for short-time happiness, short-time goals, visible goals, instantaneous goals. But this is counterproductive because we enjoy now and we pay later in the form of suffering, which could be easily avoided. So to appreciate the importance of an incarnation, one also needs an intuitive sense, a great depth of understanding, because the real work of an incarnation is not in this visible realm, but in the invisible realm of ideas. If any of you had gone to India, especially where big rivers like Ganges are there, you know the power of the sea. For 150 miles, the whole river is made to turn back on its course. We call it mhat, you know, ebb, tide. It's an amazing and frightening sight. 1 minute, the huge river is peacefully flowing towards the ocean. next minute the whole sea is as it were pushed back to its origin. It is a really frightening sight. You know, boats can be upset. We get a few examples of it in the Gospel of Ramakrishna. Thakur was watching, says, I hope the boats will not sink. Even he was frightened. An incarnation's work is, you know, the whole humanity is accustomed to think in one way, to act and react in one way, very stereotyped thinking, even when it has proved very disastrous for their happiness. But somehow an incarnation of God comes and tries to turn the whole tide. That's why it takes time. Take the example of Buddha, Rama, Krishna, Jesus, Chaitanya, Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna, of course, is a recent phenomenon. But you see, the power of Krishna, even today, there are so many people who are just overwhelmed by taking the name of Krishna. But as I said, we have to try to understand these incarnations' real significance through an intuitive mind. And a person gets an intuitive mind when he becomes really sincere and strives with prayerful attitude. So what happens then? An inner transformation takes place. This is an age when we are completely neglecting the inner transformation and absolutely focused on the external transformation, be it body, be it the way we work, be it the way we interact with each other. This is absolutely terrible, disastrous. First, it must come from within ourselves, the transformation. So the purpose of any scripture, and every incarnation is a scripture. His life and his sayings, utterances becomes a scripture. Just let me briefly mention what happens when an incarnation comes. But even before going that, how do we know who is an incarnation of God? Because there are stupid people, idiots, who are claiming their gurus are avatars. At some point of time in India, every street corner is teeming with incarnations of God. And nowadays you get internet incarnations of gurus with their internet CV, self-realized soul, documented by hundreds of other people that I know this Swami, he is a really realized soul and he is very cheap. I only have paid $50 for each one of his classes. So, Hindus classify saints or spiritual personalities into four categories. Jivan Muktas, lowest category. They realized their true nature, became free. Then, Acharyas, like Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, etc., or you can say Saint Paul as an Acharya. Their sphere of influence is much widespread, much longer duration in both time and space. But even their powers are severely limited. Then higher than this grade is what we call Ishvara Koti, the companions of the incarnations. Their power is much, much greater. For example, you know, Hanuman, even the power of Hanuman is today greater than even Rama himself. Swami Vivekananda, Swami Brahmananda, these are just a few examples. We call them Ishvara Koti, Nitya Mukta. They are ever free, but they are born with a mission in life. There are two types of births in this world. We call them karma janma and karana janma. Karma janma. We are all karma janmis. We are born because in our past life we have done certain karma and we have to reap that karma. So this instrument has come for the experience of the past karma. A few rare souls are called karana janmas. They are free. There is no karma for them. But they voluntarily, out of compassion, take birth for helping other human beings. In the Buddhism, they are called bodhisattvas. These are called karana janmas. An incarnation of God and his companions called Ishvara Kotis. And not all his companions are Ishvara Kotis. Sri Ramakrishna had only 6 Ishvara Kotis, no more than that. And Swami Vivekananda was one of them. So this is the much higher category. And the, of course, the highest category is an avatara, an incarnation of God, like Jesus, Buddha, Ramakrishna, etc. Now, how do we determine who is an acharya, who is an incarnation of God? What is the criteria? The criteria is the power they exert in the capacity of their being able to transform other people. The power of transformation. So Sri Ramakrishna had compared this thing. There is a small, you know, oil lamp, and it illumines a short space. Then there is a 1000 watts halogen lamp. It illumines a much larger area in a better way. So there is a star. It illumines a little bit. Then there is moon. It illumines much more. Then there is a sun. So what is the criteria? The power to transform. Their knowledge is absolutely same. So Sri Ramakrishna used to give an illustration. A ordinary liberated soul is like a stick floating in a river towards the ocean. It can float. But even the smallest bird sits on it, immediately it sinks. An incarnation of God is like a huge ship. Not only it can float, it can also carry hundreds of human beings, hundreds of cars, trucks, etc. So there is absolutely no difference in the content. There is only difference in the volume of the content. So, a person who has got this tremendous amount of, you know, power, he can help more people. The knowledge is absolutely same. All of them have the same knowledge. Why do they have the same knowledge? Because truth is only one. You taste one drop of milk or one grain of sugar. Another man drinks liters full of milk or eats heaps full of sugar. The knowledge of both the contents is absolutely the same. But the difference is, supposing somebody else comes, "Sir, I am hungry." The man who has only one drop, it is barely enough only to satisfy him. But a man who has barrel fulls of milk, he can give it, "Okay, you also take, you also take, you also take." So an avatara is compared to an ocean. An ocean has tremendous power. This analogy is not absolutely correct because even an incarnation of God has limited powers. It works for a long time in our calculation, but it won't work forever. That is one problem even with incarnations. The second problem is that the truth these incarnations propagate is absolutely the same. Whether it is Jesus, Christ, or Buddha, or Rama, or Krishna, what they are trying to tell about the truth is absolutely the same because truth is only one. But they have to present it in a way so that in a particular idiom, in a particular language, in a particular way, and in a particular context, so that the present time people can easily grasp what they are talking about. But otherwise, the truth is absolutely the same. You know, in a school, a brother and sister were studying. So the teacher had set a task for them, write an essay on a cow. And both these brother, sister was elder and the brother was younger. Both of them presented their essays. And the teacher first looked into the essay of the sister, girl, and it was very good. Then he looked into the essay. It was absolutely comma, full stop included, the same essay. So the teacher called the boy and said, "Why do I find your essay is absolutely the same like your sister's?" He said, "Sir, it is because it is the same cow." What a wonderful answer. If it is a different cow, then there would be a different description. If it is the same cow, the description should be the same. In a way, all great teachers are telling the same truth. And in his own inimitable language, Sri Ramakrishna had expressed this great truth. All jackals howl the same way all over the world. Because all are jackals. Jackal means here compared all realized souls. Truth is only one. Truth cannot be many. Falsehood is many. Truth is only one and it never changes. You know, there was a man who used to steal. So he was caught, taken to the magistrate, and the magistrate had given him some time in the jail. And after that he was released. And at the time of questioning him, the magistrate asked him, "What is your age?" He said, "I am 30 years old." So after 5 years, again he was caught, brought before the magistrate. He was asked, "What is your age?" He said, 30 years old. Magistrate said, "But you fellow, you gave the same answer 5 years back." He said, "You know, gentlemen, truthful people, never change their words." But even better joke is there, you know. There was this fellow, and he was stealing. And he used to be brought before the magistrate. And the magistrate would give him some time in the jail. Again and again and again, as soon as he goes out, he will steal again, he will be caught, and then he will be brought. The magistrate got, you know, bored. So once he was brought, he was asked, "Why do I see you again and again in front of me?" Man folded his hands and said, "If you don't get promotion, don't blame me." So, truth is the same, and that essential truth must transform us. But though it is true, truth is only one, if it comes from the mouth of a person who has not realized that truth, it will not have that transforming effect. So, an incarnation essentially comes for these two reasons. One, he generates faith in us that this is the truth. See, in simple words, he generates faith in us about God. God is existing, he can be seen, he can be realized. And the second is, he presents an ideal suited for the present age. We must never forget, Rama told the truth. Rama's teachings are truthful teachings. But Rama's life is not an ideal life for this particular age. So also Krishna's life. He married 16,108 wives. Certainly it is not an ideal for this age. So a person must lead that life. It is not enough that the truth is told. We need to derive inspiration from, and inspiration cannot come from books. It can only come from a life lived. This is where whenever you read Sri Ramakrishna's life, it didn't happen thousands of years back. It just happened and he led a very contented life. That's why Sri Ramakrishna is very effective. But what he taught was exactly what Krishna had taught. What Krishna taught was exactly what Rama had taught. And what Rama had taught was exactly what the previous incarnation had taught. In Gita there is a sentence, he tells Arjuna that I have been born. Arjuna asked a question. And Krishna says, this question was asked of me by Manu thousands of years back. And I know the answer, so I am going to give you. Because it is the same question, the answer is also exactly the same. Arjuna was surprised. You are my contemporary. We are born just a few years back. How come you claim you have given this answer thousands of years back? And Sri Krishna says, I have been born many times, so also you, but you have forgotten about it. I haven't forgotten. It is this essential fact. Sri Ramakrishna says, he who is Rama and who was Krishna in this present age, it is the same being which has incarnated taking the name of Ramakrishna. So we sing Gahore Jai Jai, Jai Ram Jai Krishna, Vishya Guru Ramakrishna. It is the same. So don't, these are all dresses. Rama is one dress, Krishna is another dress, Ramakrishna is another dress. But what is inside, it is absolutely the same being. Bhagavad Gita compares a human body to a dress. You know, when this dress becomes old, what do? You throw it away. Sometimes you throw it away. When you see advertisement, you know, buy one, get two, then also you will throw it away. Okay, coming back, what happens when an incarnation comes? Keep in mind what I told you. How do Hindus measure an incarnation of God? By the amount of power they exert through time and space. The greater the power, the wider it spreads. And for the duration in time, the power of Buddha, even though 2500 years back, the power of Christ, even though 2000 years back, power of Krishna, even though many thousands of years back, still it is very potent. And so we cannot assess the power of Ramakrishna in these short, after all it is only 120 years. But even within this short time, you see how his message is spreading. Now in this context, I would just like to add one thought. That Sri Ramakrishna once made a statement, whoever had prayed to God sincerely once in his life, he must come to me. What does that statement mean? Does it mean to say that everybody will come to know that here is Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and this is where he was born and lived and this is what he did? Not necessarily, but his ideas. What are the most important ideas? That I will summarize later on, but to be very brief, that you are divine and there is great potentiality within each one of you. And there is a way to manifest that potentiality, and he had come to demonstrate it through his own life. This is the simple fact. So to summarize, what do these incarnations teach? Only one simple fact. How to make us remember our forgotten nature, divinity. If you remember this, you know these teachings of all incarnations, all scriptures. Okay. Whenever an incarnation comes, some things occur as a very natural corollary. First thing that happens is that their name becomes a mantra. whether it is Christ, whether it is Buddha, whether it is Rama, whether it is Krishna, their name itself becomes a mantra. Have you noticed that? Lord Jesus Christ, save me, a sinner, out of your mercy. The Jesus mantra. Krishna mantra. Rama mantra. Rama Rama Japa, you know? Or Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Rama. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, whatever. Their name becomes a mantra. And here is a very curious fact about Hindus. Hindus are God makers. You know, every religion teaches is God who makes us. Hindus claim that they make gods. You know, Rama was a man, they made him God. Krishna was a man, they made him a God. Chaitanya was a man, they made him God. And Ramakrishna was a man and he was made God. Hindus have that tremendous ability and say that even if you are not an incarnation of God, I have the power to make you an incarnation of God. I will put you up on an altar and I will make you an incarnation of God. You have no choice but to be an incarnation of God. Hindus have that tremendous ability. Now, Hindu gods fall into two categories. Conceptual gods, transformed gods. Conceptual gods is, man's mind thinks there must be a creator, there must be a person who looks after us, protects us, etc. These are like Vishnu, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Saraswati, Lakshmi, etc., etc. These are called conceptual gods. And transformed gods means man, a human being, transformed into the status of a god. But to make this possibility, Hindus must have a powerful idea behind it. Theory, if you like it, to call it. What is the theory? Brahmavit Brahmaiva Bhavati. A knower of Brahman is Brahma. He becomes Brahma. It is absolutely true. I won't go into that. But we are what our knowledge is. This is the truth. If you have right knowledge, your life will be right. If you have wrong knowledge, then it will be a misery. This is a wonderful truth. We are what our knowledge is. Anyway, so if a person has realized God and his power is tremendous, he is transformed into an incarnation of God. So this is how this theory of incarnation has gained ground. And whenever an incarnation comes, faith is generated about higher truths. What do you mean by higher truth? Again, we can crystallize it in a simple way, saying that higher truth means the truth about you and me. You are God, you are divine. So there is no doubt about it. We can never deny the existence of ourselves. And how do we know that we are divine? Don't take it in the extreme sense, but taking in a commonsensical way, here is a baby. Here are, say, two babies. Do you know what is the potentiality of these two babies? One may become president of the United States. Another may become a vagabond. You just don't know. So, can you judge the baby and say this baby is going to be a president? When he is in the baby, but that seed must have been in that baby, otherwise it would never become a fact. But this analogy is also not a good analogy, because Vedanta doesn't believe that there is a good seed and there is a bad seed. All seeds are good seeds. Some reach earlier, some reach a little bit later. That's all. So it is to teach this tremendous possibility, human possibility, that an incarnation of God comes. And how does he inspire us? Through the production of faith. And this wonderful word, faith. You know, we think, I believe in God, but I don't believe in myself. What a contradictory statement. If you believe in God, necessarily you have to believe in yourself, because Your faith in yourself is what makes God stand. This is a different subject. It will take time. I will not go into it. That's why Swami Vivekananda said, in the olden times, people misunderstood religion, saying that religion is faith in God who is somewhere else. But the modern religion says, he who has faith in himself, he is a believer. Otherwise, he is a Gnostic, non-believer. Okay. Whenever an incarnation comes, what did I say? His name becomes a mantra. And his form becomes one of the forms of God, deity. He becomes like Vishnu, like Saraswati. His form is worship. We are worshipping Ramakrishna's form. This form is divine for the devotees of Ramakrishna. And millions are worshipping Ramakrishna today in that way. That is the second factor. The third factor that happens only in the life of incarnations, not others. The life and teachings of every incarnation becomes a powerful scripture guiding millions of people. Take Rama, Ramayana. Take Krishna, Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam. Take Jesus Christ, the New Testament. Take Buddha, the three Pitakas. And then his life, people meditate upon his life. People meditate upon the teachings. That becomes a framework of reference for judging the criteria of other truths. So, the third factor that happens is that the life and teachings of every real incarnation, if it is a false incarnation, they will be like meteors. For a few days, you know, people will read and then there will be no power of transformation. They will fall down. But a true incarnation, their life teachings become a very valuable scripture. Why did I say valuable? Because there are many scriptures in the world. Supposing there is a book in front of you. That book itself will not help you. You need a torch light to be able to read that book. So the life and teachings of an incarnation becomes a powerful torch light. In the sense, they will give you a correct way of interpreting other scriptures. Otherwise, you can misinterpret scriptures, and which will bring a great misery. So this is the third thing that happens when God incarnates. And there is a fourth factor. After every incarnation, an organization comes. After Rama, Ramayat sadhus. After Krishna, Vaishnava sadhus. After Shankaracharya, Dashanami Sampradaya. After Christ, Christian monasteries, etc. have come. The purpose of these organizations is to illuminate the life and teachings of the incarnations in a correct way and to make his teachings accessible to a larger proportion of people. But unfortunately, there is a defect in this. Every organization degenerates over time and misinterprets the teachings of the founder, and that is how dharma declines. It's a small story, you know. Jesus Christ, God had incarnated as Jesus Christ. And then Satan. You know Satan? Oh, you know Satan. Satan ran to God and said, God, God, you have done a great injustice to me. And God said, what injustice have I done to you? No, you sent your son. And then, what is my work? If everybody listens to your son, then what do I do? God said, that is true. I have not thought about it until now. Okay, I will give you organization. It is true, in the beginning, the organization really is a bulwark of support, true interpretation, keeping up the ideals of the incarnation and all that. But as time goes on, it becomes degenerated for some reason. This is an inevitable fact in life. We have to accept. There is nothing called perfectly pure organization going for centuries together. Whether it is Christian monasteries or Buddhist monasteries or Indian monasteries, every organization is another name for degeneration. It takes time. Like a river which starts at the source, so pure, but as it goes on spreading, what happens? Becomes dirtier and impure and powerless. Okay. These are the four things that happen. The first three, the name, which is a mantra, the form is an object of meditation, and the life of teaching. They remain eternally alive until that particular yuga, we call it yuga, is gone, lasts, as long as the yuga lasts. But organization very soon, means within even our own time, we can see the degeneration happening. Okay. Now coming back, Sri Krishna had exerted a very powerful influence, like Sri Ramakrishna, and there are so many similarities. What he did was harmonize the past with the present and weave a beautiful path for the future. He harmonized certain incompatible principles. I will not go into details because they are not relevant for most of us now. So, one example I will give you. Before Krishna, there was a philosophy called Sankhya, which enumerates two eternal principles, Prakriti and Purusha, absolutely incompatible with each other. In the Gita, we see a beautiful synthesis and says, these are not two separate, irreconcilable principles, but these are part of me. One is my lower nature, another is my higher nature. Prakriti is my lower nature, Purusha is my higher nature. Para Prakriti and Apara Prakriti. There is no conflict here. A beautiful synthesis. And the reality is one and not many. He did it. Then he brought about a beautiful reconciliation like Sri Ramakrishna between these four yogas. You know, there was a lot of the followers of knowledge, say ours is shortcut and supreme, and this devotional path is for weak-minded and emotional, unreliable people. And within the devotional sects also, there is a lot of conflict. Do you know that in India? India is a supermarket. Hinduism is like a supermarket of religions. We enter into the supermarket. So what do you want to follow? Path of knowledge, Shankaracharya, etc. Go that way, that department. And you follow devotion? Okay, it is left side. Okay, which incarnation do you want? Krishna incarnation. There is a huge departmental stores, all separate by itself. Krishna department. Not apartment, department. And you go there, and it is subdivided. Which Krishna you want? You want Balakrishna? You want Gopala Krishna? You want Gita Krishna? You want politician Krishna? You have a choice to choose from. This often confuses people. But what did Sri Krishna say? He said, every yoga is a pathway to God. Essentially, there is no conflict at all. How wonderfully Sri Ramakrishna had to reiterate the same truth. In gospel we get, you know, this. There are people who worship Krishna. They claim that Krishna is the only, the boatman who takes one across this ocean of samsara to Brahman. The followers of the Divine Mother, Shaktas they are called, Shakti worshippers. They claim our Divine Mother is the queen of this universe, Jagajanani. And it is she alone who can take one across this ocean of samsara. The Krishna devotees, Vaishnavas, they dispute with that and say, no, it is only Krishna. not your Divine Mother. And the followers of Divine Mother say, we agree with you. You are absolutely right. Krishna is the boatman. Our Divine Mother is queen. Why should she row a boat? She employed a fellow called Krishna to do that work. What a beautiful way of saying it. Sri Ramakrishna came and said, these are all useless type of disputes. The thing is, whether you worship Krishna, whether you worship Divine Mother, what are you in yourself? Has any transformation taken place within you? Has this religion helped you? I gave the definition of Vedanta the 2 days back. What is that? Whatever helps a person, that alone is true religion. Whatever makes us better people, growing in goodness, growing in happiness, that alone is religion. The rest is, you may be a great scholar, but it is absolutely no use. So, Krishna had beautifully harmonized, synthesized. And his greatest statement in the Bhagavad Gita is, whoever is calling on whichever form of God anywhere in this world, he is only calling upon me. And I, through that particular form, strengthen that person's faith and I fulfill the desires of that devotee through that particular form. But all are coming towards me only. Everybody only is calling upon me. Me means here, not Krishna. The Krishna as a deity is separate. Here I means Brahman, Atman. That is the idea he gave. So he was a great synthesizer. So now Krishna's greatest teachings are embodied in two most beautiful works. Many of us are aware of his beautiful work, which is called Bhagavad Gita. But there is even more beautiful work, which is called Uddhava Gita. Uddhava Gita. In Bhagavatam, we get it. So, there is not much time for us to go through these 18 chapters, but we must be intelligent enough to squeeze the essence of Bhagavad Gita, and then we can slowly ponder over them and try to understand them. In my own way, I tried to make these teachings in a few simple points, and I think that would be a great help. How did Gita start? In a battlefield, Dharma Kshetre Kurukshetre. There is a significance, there is a meaning. Life is a battlefield, but a just battlefield, and there is no escape. If anyone is thinking that he will have a very cozy and comfortable and beautiful life without any conflict, he will be a doormat. Without conflict, nobody had ever progressed. And if we are seeking for comfortable life, we would become snails. Our progress will be a snail's progress. Did I tell you that? A man was sitting in his room. The front door was closed. Suddenly he heard a scratching noise. So he went, opened the door, looked. There was nobody. There must be some cause for the noise. Suddenly he looked, there was a small snail trying to enter into his room. So he, with his finger, he just flipped it like that and closed the door and went inside. 10 years passed. One day he was sitting, door was closed, there was a scrapping noise. He went and opened the door and he looked here, there, nobody was there. He looked down, he saw the snail. Snail looked up at him and, what was all that about? It took that snail 10 years to come back and say, what was all that about? You just picked me up. Without conflict, there is no progress. Without suffering, there is no invention. That is why there is a beautiful saying in English. What is that? Suffering, necessity is the mother of invention. When do you think you have a necessity? When do you think you will be having necessity? Only when you are suffering. When there is a struggle. Struggle is the nature of life. If you don't struggle, you are a dead person. And many are the living dead. That is why once the Maharaja of Khetri asked Swami Vivekananda a very important question. What is life, Swamiji Maharaj? You know what was the answer he gave? Life is the unfoldment of a being under circumstances trying to press it down. What a beautiful reply he replied. If there is no struggle, there is no life. When you don't struggle, you will be dead. So, life is a battlefield, but a just battlefield. It will give you exactly the result of what you struggle for, what you strive for. And there is no escape. If we understand this, then we understand the significance of Gita. Had there been no battlefield, would there have been a Gita? Just imagine. Okay. One of the most wonderful teachings of Gita in the second chapter. Nasato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha. Ubhayorapi drushtontastvanayo tatvadarsivihi. The reality has no non-existence. The unreality has no existence. And those who have knowledge, they know the truth about these two things. This verse has puzzled so many people. In simple words, what it means is, if something is true, it is true. If it is not true, it is not true. Can we put it in simpler terms than this? So, if somebody is trying to murder you, if it is true, it is true. If somebody is not trying to murder you, if it is not true, it is not true. But what do we do? What is true, we mistake as untrue. What is untrue, we become suspicious. You know how suspicion kills people? Harasses people, brings havoc, wrecks havoc, and even people commit suicide. So what is the truth about it? Here you see, if you are a divine being, if your existence is real, there is no power on earth which can make you non-divine, there is no power on earth which can make you go out of existence. Is it right? There is nothing called death. But if your existence is really only a false thing, a non-existence, whatever you do, you are not going to exist. Try to understand the implications of this. What a wonderful statement. In more ways than one, psychologically more ways than one, if we understand this, many of our problems will go away. There is a beautiful word in Sanskrit language. It is called, chinta. You know what is chinta? Chinta means worry. You know, there is a similar word in Sanskrit. It is called chita. But you know what is chita? Funeral fire. There is very little difference between chita and chinta. You see, there is a lot of words like that. Many people don't know the difference, Shraddha and Shraddha. There is a lot of differences there. Shraddha is funeral ceremony. Shraddha is intense true faith. and some people Brahma and Brahma. Be very careful about the Sanskrit language. And there is also a lot of difference between Arati and Arti.
Yes.
Arati is vesper service. Arti is distress. You know, that's a very beautiful word. So, coming back, supposing now you are worry. A worry is a person who worries. He is a person burning throughout life. So that is why in the Sanskrit there is a verse which says, Chita means funeral pyre burns a man only
once.
But this Chinta burns a man day and night until his death. So why does worry come? Why does worry happen? Because, you know, if something is going to happen, it is going to happen. In any case, you have to accept it. If it is not going to happen, it is not going to happen. There is no need to worry about it. Really, reasonable speaking, logically speaking, it is true. There was a clinic called Don't Worry Clinic. Did I tell you about that? So a patient went there and asked the doctor, that doctor, is a strange title you have given to your clinic. What do you mean by explain? He said, very simple. Suppose you come to me and I treat you. Two things will happen. No more than that. Either you get well or you don't get well. If you get well, well, no worry. If you don't get well, two things will happen. Either you go to heaven or you go to hell. If you go to heaven, nothing to worry. But if you go to hell, you will meet a lot of your old friends. What is there to worry? You will have a merry time. No worry clinic. So, if something has to happen, it will happen. If something will not happen, it will not happen. Simple logic. So what is the point in worrying? You apply this logic to any situation. You applied for a job. How many things can happen? Either you get a job or you don't. If you get a job, that's fine. If you don't get a job, then you have to accept the fact and try some other place. Similarly, about health. Similarly, about anything, somebody is either your friend or he is not your friend. If you apply this kind of logic, worry should not trouble us so much. Of course, you know, we are human beings. A little amount of anxiety will be there, but not out of the reasonable proportion. This is very important. This is a practical thing I am telling you. So, how do we cope with these things? Hindus have two ways of coping with this. You know, one way, usually, you know, only we worry only when we are suffering, when we are enjoying. We rarely, excepting a pessimist, now it is all right, but tomorrow what will happen? So Hindus, all over the world, humanity has to face this problem. Fortunately, animals don't suffer from that. And saints also don't suffer from that. It is the in-between people always suffer from that. So, how do people cope? They have evolved two methods. One method is the law of karma. I must have done something in the past, and so I have to accept this. It doesn't alter the facts, but it alters our response, consciousness. That is important. This is how we counter even bad karma, which is an important point, I will shortly come. So, the other way is, everything is God's will. You cannot go against God's will. As we say, you know, even a leaf doesn't move without God's will. So, either way, it gives us that strength of mind to accept what do these two things do is a very important transformation in our psyche, in our consciousness. What is that? We accept the fact. And the moment we accept something, that automatically reduces the quantum of suffering. Do you know that? If you don't accept, you suffer doubly. This is a, animals don't suffer. If they, there is pain, they only suffer the pain. Human beings, they can either enjoy doubly or they can suffer doubly. So what is this double suffering? Now supposing a person, an animal is suffering, say from injury, leg injury, let us say. So what happens? It knows this is suffering, but it doesn't go and say, why the hell am I suffering? It doesn't add to that suffering. Whereas a human being, why am I suffering? Who is responsible? If he, he will never blame himself, either his wife or God. Other way round also happens. Whoever is nearest, we take it out upon that person, you know. How foolish human beings are. But these two types of things, attitudes, they make us accept suffering. Therefore, they may not change circumstances. But sometimes circumstances also can be changed by this attitude. I will give one simple example to illustrate this point. Suppose you are caught in a traffic jam and there is nothing you can do. If you don't accept, you go on, you know, glaring at other people, blaming other people or yourself or anything. If you accept, then what a mind becomes, calm. Then you say, okay, this is a fact. I am caught here. What can I do? Can I listen to some music? Can I think of God? Can I do japam? Or can I read some small book? You know, any number of ways present themselves as soon as the mind is very quiet. So these two attitudes have helped Hindus a lot. One is, it is maybe my past karma, I have to pay it. Or maybe it is God's will, there must be some good that comes out of it. This really helps. So this is what the in this verse is telling. If something is real, it is real. If something is unreal, it has no existence. And therefore, if your body is unreal, there is nothing you can do about it. It will come, it will go. This idea has been expounded and expanded later on. This, you know, all living creatures, they were not there before. The body comes into manifestation at some point, and then it lives for some time, and then it goes back. This is an inevitable process. Why did Krishna say this? Because Arjuna's main, you know, rationalization was, I am going to kill all these people. What is he going to kill really?
Just the body.
It is the bodies. And do you think Arjuna will live, suppose he doesn't kill? Do you think they are going to live forever? They are going to die at some point of time. In time, all of us will die. That is why, in response to Krishna's question, who are you? I am unable to recognize you. It says, Kaloham. I am Kala. And in Kala, the whole Srishti comes, it remains for some time and it disappears. Everything happens by Kala. Okay. So, Krishna had clarified, the truth will always be real, it will be there. The untruth is always unreal, even if you think it is there, like a dream, it will pass away. So this is a frame of mind through which we should interpret everything connected with our life. And that is a great help. So that is one of the most important teachings of Gita. Third, then real man and unreal man. Based on this, the Lord says, but Arjuna, you are thinking you are killing Bhishma. The real man is Atman. What is the other thing? Body and mind is only an instrument. This instrument comes and goes. But the real man neither comes nor goes, neither is born. Najayate mriyate va. Have you read that in the Bhagavad Gita? The Atman is never born. It is not that it is born and stays for some time and then goes out of manifest. It is only the body mind which comes and goes. And therefore don't worry. What is the consequence? The consequence is you are not the killer. Neither a person is killed. He who thinks he is the killer and he who thinks he is the killed, both are completely ignorant. Because what is killed and what kills is only the external body, not the real essence of man. This is the greatest contribution of Vedanta to the world's religious thought, the concept of Atman. The implications of it we will not discuss right now, but what I want, this is very practical thing, what I want to point out is this is the most important teaching, the distinction between the real man and the apparent man. Within each one of us there is a real essence and then unreal manifestation. This body, mind, no amount of medicine, no amount of modern technology can keep it there. But the real essence is unchanging. That is what we should focus upon, really speaking. Based upon these teachings so far, number four, Krishna says, the goal of life is to realize one's true nature. How do we know? Because at the end he asks, now have you heard my teaching? And what is the result? The result, Arjuna says, now I know who I am. Okay. So this is, what is the good of knowing who we are? We all want, like children, can I get candy? If I think of God, yes, you will get candy and much more. But getting candy is not the real purpose of thinking about God. You will get, but you will get something much, much more valuable than that. So there is one verse which is so wonderful. Yam labdhva cha aparam labham manyate nadhikam tataha yasmin stito na dukkhena gurunapi vichalyate. The meaning of this shloka verse is that having obtained which, man thinks there is no other greater thing which is more profitable than this, which is the highest happiness. And having obtained which state or which realization, even the greatest amount of suffering can be tolerated as though it is a child's play. Na dukkhena guruna api vichara. He is not shaken. He is not disturbed. His mind is not disturbed. Because he knows this is a very temporary phase. It is like a cinema. We all enjoy when there is a happy scene. And when an unhappy scene is, even then we enjoy. There is a kind of emotion, fear, and when one is like that. But we know inside us, this is just a show, this is not the reality. This realization of the self gives us that greatest happiness and the greatest strength to put up even with the greatest amount of suffering. This is the benefit of realizing the self. Yam labdhva cha aparam labham manyate na adhikam tatha. There is no greater gain than this. Means what is the greatest gain? Happiness. And gurunapi dukkhena na vichalyate, is not disturbed. But one thing we have to take note here is Krishna is not telling by realizing God you will not undergo some suffering. The world will be world. Even Rama had to undergo the suffering, Krishna has to undergo suffering, but they won't react as we want to react. That is the greatest benefit. This goal can be reached, and Sri Krishna assures us, Bahunam Janmanamante Gnanavan Mam Prapadyate Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samahatma Sudurlabha. Do not expect spiritual progress to be a straightforward, linear type of progress, from progress to progress. It goes more like a wave-like motion. Sometimes we go down, sometimes we go up. But it is not exactly like a wave-like motion. It is like a spiral staircase. You seem to come back to the point where you were before. But every time you come back, you are one step higher than where you were before. So we have a notion always from progress will be in a higher and higher. No. Sometimes they are like going down a valley, sometimes climbing up a mountain, again going down. This would be the nature of progress, because that is the nature of the world in which we are. Then, how can this realization be attained? Through yoga. And what is yoga? Very interesting definitions are given about yoga. There are three important definitions of yoga. One definition is yoga karmasu kaushalam. Yoga is dexterity in action. What does dexterity mean? Karma kushalatva. It means that our mind is so controlled. Yoga means mind control. So focused, so concentrated. Any work can be done in the most efficient manner, in the quickest possible way of time, because the mind is really focused. But that is not the real meaning of this. Kaushala means you will get all the benefits without paying anything. You use your credit card, buy whatever you want, but the bank forgets to take money from your account. What a marvelous thing it is. That is called karma kaushala. You won't be caught by the negative effects of karma. Karma, on the other hand, will help you forge forward towards your destination. That is the meaning of one definition of yoga. The other definition of yoga he gives is dukkha sanyoga viyogam. Even amidst the greatest suffering, that you live as though there is no suffering. That is called yoga. Like a lotus leaf in the water. It is in the water, but the water does not affect the lotus leaf. But the other word, the third word, which I want to bring to your notice, samatvam yoga ucchyate. Samatva means balance. Is the most important word definition according to me. Balance. Everything balance. How much you have to work, how much you watch your TV, how much you talk to people, how much food you eat, how much you sleep. If there is no balance, then you will become unbalanced, which is not good. This is yoga. Everything has a proportion. Even cooking has a proportion. You know, salt is very good. Without salt, curry doesn't taste. But if you, out of proportion, if you put so much salt. But it too has its own uses. You know, one woman devotee used to come to me in Alsur when I was in Bangalore. She complained once to me, Swamiji, so many acquaintances, friends come to me. They want to eat my cooking. I am tired. Actually, she wanted a compliment. She said, see how nicely I cook, so many people are coming. But I am not one to be taken in so easily. You know, I told her, what is the problem? Add a little more salt to your cooking. From next day onwards, even if you invite them also, they will not come. Even if you pay their taxi fare also, they will not. So don't put my teachings into practice when I come to your house. Samatvam yoga, which is harmony. This is the key word for beauty. We say anything, you know, cooking is beautiful, painting is beautiful, poetry is beautiful, anything, nature, scenery is beautiful. What is the secret? Harmony. Everything is in proportion. It is very important how much we work. You overwork, You will have no energy left over for meditation. And you underwork, an ideal brain becomes devil's workshop. This balance is yoga, and I think it is one of the most important key points in Bhagavad Gita. So, the secret of success of any yoga is mind control. And there are four yogas. I will not go into them. You know that? Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga. But the secret of any yoga is all the success in any field depends upon one factor. What is that factor? Mind control. And how do we get mind control? It is specifically Sri Krishna deals with the subject in detail. I am only summarizing it. The first thing he says is, don't expect somebody else to control your mind. Actually, that is counterproductive, because a hypnotist, for example, you go to a hypnotist and it is very dangerous, because you are selling your mind. You do whatever you like. Of course, you expect that person will cure you of some bad habit or whatever. That is fine. But suppose you are allowing your mind to be weakened, giving it to others and say, you do whatever you like with me, because it is your suggestion that I need. Unless the strength comes from within you, you become a slave, very soon a slave to any passerby, to any passing suggestion, and that is a terrible thing. So Vedanta doesn't approve of hypnosis. Don't ask me. There is a lot of truth in it. So Sri Krishna says, Uddhare Atmana Atmana. You uplift yourself by your own self. And if you have controlled your mind by your own discipline and effort, that mind becomes your greatest friend. And your own uncontrolled mind becomes your greatest enemy. This is a very beautiful teaching. So, how can we control our mind? This is an eternal question. So, Sri Krishna gives a beautiful answer through two practices, simultaneous practices. What are they? Abhyasa and Vairagya. Now, we have many times Abhyasa, but not Vairagya. You know, both must go together. What is Abhyasa? Repeatedly practicing until it becomes a second nature. But many of us, we get up, we do japam, we do rituals and all those things. That is, Abhyasa is there. But Vairagya is necessary. What is Vairagya? A discriminative faculty by which we avoid what should be avoided. Otherwise, like sleepwalkers, we go through the same routine. And it doesn't help. It does help, but it will take a long time. If we want quick progress, then simultaneously Abhyasa must be supported by what is called dispassion. Dispassion. So, the next point is, what are the best yogas? What, in the opinion of Sri Krishna, what is the best yogas? He says a judicious combination of bhakti yoga and karma yoga. Because we are emotionally and exuberant. And we are also active oriented. Without action, we feel bored in life. Is it not? That is why beautiful combination. You use bhakti yoga, but at the same time karma yoga. The karma yoga is a guide for us in our day-to-day, according to our station, according to our age, and according to the work or profession we are involved with. And emotionally, with ourselves, with our family, with our colleagues, and with the world. If we can somehow control and purify these two, that is the quickest, most easily obtainable and natural and suitable for most of us. Especially in this age, we are workaholics and also emotional alcoholics. There is a beautiful book had come, Emotional Intelligence by David Goleman, if you have not heard about it. So it's a very perceptive book. So go through it. So according to Krishna, Bhakti Yoga and Karma Yoga, the combination of these two, the most suitable for this. That's what Sri Ramakrishna also had advocated. Sri Ramakrishna's gospel says that be a bhakta. How many hospitals will you open? By that you can mistake Sri Ramakrishna saying probably he discourages this karma yoga. What did Swami Vivekananda teach? Karma yoga. Why do you think he had taught? Was he on his own or was he only reflecting Sri Ramakrishna's teachings? He was only talking about Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. But a judicious combination of karma and bhakti is the best for this Kali Yuga. This fact has been clearly stated by Swami Sharadananda in his great book, Sri Ramakrishna, the Great Master, if you have not read it. Next point is, progress always happens in three stages. Any progress always takes place in three stages, from the lowest to the highest. What are these three? From instinct to reason to intuition, from tamas to rajas to sattva. There is no way we can bypass the middle one and jump from tamas to sattva, from instinct to intuition. We have to necessarily go through these pathways. And that is why Swami Vivekananda advocated so much of activity, service, etc. for people. Indians used to think they are the greatest spiritual people in this world. Most of them are peepoo pieces. The next point is, no one can progress in any field of life excepting through God's grace. This is a point Sri Krishna emphasized. This is a point Sri Ramakrishna also said. Nobody can see God excepting through His grace. It is a very important point. It doesn't mean you will sit until God's grace comes. Why? Because it is not that God's grace hasn't come. Already God's grace has come to us, this beautiful human body, this wonderful opportunity, this desire for spiritual life, this is nothing but a proof of God's grace. And He has given you discriminating faculty. What else do you want? There are millions of people who do not have this opportunity. Billions of creatures who are not human. Millions of human beings who have to live such a life, even if they want to be spiritual, it is very difficult for them. Not impossible, but difficult for them. Manushyatvam, mumukshutvam, maha apurusha samshayaha. So this is, you know, human birth, the desire for improvement in life, and the company of, you know, supportive people, devotees and excellent friends. This is God's grace. So let us not waste this wonderful grace of God. Even for those who follow the path of knowledge, God says, I will give them buddhi yogam dadamyaham. How does God's grace come? In the form of right understanding. You know, it's the most wonderful thing. I want God's grace. You know, how does it come? In the form of a football from the sky or what? It comes in the form of right understanding. When a man understands rightly, he says, well, I am born as a human being and my body is healthy and my mind is very intelligent and I have this wonderful opportunity. And if I don't use this opportunity, who will suffer? Who will lose? I will lose. This understanding comes only by God, through God's grace. Next point is most wonderful point. No one is excluded from God, however sinful, says. Even the worst sinful person, if he also has potentiality to become God, if only he turns his face to me, I will attract him, I will run towards him, I will pull him up. What a marvelous message. Not only that, he says, man has no choice but to go to God. The only choice is, he might go next birth or after a million births, time wise, but there is no choice whether to remain human or to become spiritual. We have to become spiritual. Why not try for it now? This is the message of hope. The last point, he says, complete self-surrender to me is the easy and sure way to realize your true nature. This is the last shloka which we discussed yesterday in my talk. Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam raja aham tva sarvapapebhyo mokshayishyami mashuja. These are the 11 points. In my opinion, these summarize the very essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So even though we didn't have that opportunity to go through every shloka or whatever, and we do not need about it, this is the essence. And if we understand it and then pray to God and make the right effort, we will be blessed by God, not only in a spiritual way, but even in a material way. Prosperity comes through yoga. Do you know that? Yoga means spiritual life. Through spiritual life, one can have material prosperity. Shuchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Bhrashto Abhijayate. Sri Krishna says, if a person practices spiritual disciplines, hasn't realized God, is he not losing this world as well as the other world? Sri Krishna says, no. As a result of his spiritual practice, he will enjoy wonderful material prosperity. And having fulfilled the desires, then his mind will completely turn towards me. The Bhagavad Gita teachings, even to learn Sanskrit, they are very easy. But whether it is an officer, a housewife, a servant, a student, a cook, is a practical Vedanta. Practice day-to-day life, we get immense benefits. And the greatest benefit is, you don't need to go to a psychiatrist, lie down on a stupid couch and pay for it $100 an hour. And nowadays it must be even more. You know, in the psychiatry is very costly thing. Do you know in this, in America? You know, one man went to a modern psychiatric clinic and they have automated everything. There was nobody. As soon as he entered the door, welcome, we are privileged to have you as our most valued customer. If you are suffering from, there were two doors. There was nobody, only announcement. Two doors, left side one door, right side one door. If you are suffering from superiority complex, enter through the right sided door. If you are suffering from inferiority complex, enter from the left sided door. So the man entered through the left sided door. There was also nobody. He found himself in between two doors. If your income is above $50,000, enter through the right sided door. But unfortunately, his income was below 50,000. If it is below 50,000, enter through the left side door. He entered through the left side door, found himself on the back street of the clinic. Psychiatry is very costly. If a person practices yoga, physically he would be healthy, mentally he would be healthy, spiritually he would make progress, and in course of time, he would reach the ultimate goal and becomes blessed. So, as I first started this class, we use the word Shanti, because we, three times, because we suffer from three kinds of afflictions. Here is the remedy for the physical afflictions, mental afflictions, and spiritual afflictions. And to understand Gita properly, we can take the help of Sri Ramakrishna's gospel and or the teachings of Swami Vivekananda. They are nothing but Gita teachings put in the simplest, most modern English language. You won't get, nobody can talk or write better than Swami Vivekananda. His language, even from the language point of view, is super. Super. Just imagine, this he did 100 years back. So these teachings are nothing but Gita in modern, simple, modern, understandable prose language. So I think I tried to bring out the most salient points, and I also succeeded to some extent in not allowing you to go into samadhi. I'm sure you enjoyed the talks as much as I enjoyed. So probably next year we can have some more talks. But I pray, may the Lord bless all of us to understand properly, to lead a proper life. Om Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chanuramardhanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum. If you have any questions or anything to say, you can say a few minutes before we are called for a better purpose.
Please wait here till we call.
Samia, I just wanted to have a little better understanding. Then you said we have to follow hand in hand Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga.
Yeah.
But somewhere Swami Vivekananda also mentioned that have Jnana Yoga as your rudder, like birds to flaps are Karma Yoga.
Yeah. What I meant was, I didn't say that we don't, you see, no yoga can be practiced by disregarding other faculties. So jnana means knowledge. Before we do practice any yoga, we need to have knowledge that I am here and there is a beautiful place there, and there is a real possibility that I can reach that place and enjoy more. If that knowledge is not there, then we can have. So jnana yoga means have the firm knowledge of who we are, what is our goal, what is the right way, and what is the way to reach that goal. That is jnana yoga. Second, raja yoga. I didn't mention much. What is raja yoga? That strength of will by which we keep our goal always in the mind, never forgetting about it. Meditation. Meditation on our goal, meditation where we are, meditation how we can progress further. But I'm simplifying. There are some people who sit alone, and that is an exclusive path for a few people. Jnana Marga similarly is an exclusive path for a few people. Jnana as the goal and Jnana as a path, these are two distinct things. It is not meant for most of us, because true faculties are very dominant within us. One is we are very emotional people, and the second is we are very active people. We cannot keep quiet. By our nature, we are very active. So these two faculties must be purified and directed towards God. And they are not conflicting faculties. And therefore, they can be combined harmoniously. That's what Gita is telling, Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. Yes.
So I'm thinking I ask something. Many people think that in olden days, there was no TV, no newspaper, and books were not so much. So transference of knowledge was from guru to shishya. But these days, books are available, TV is available. So do you really need a guru?
Before I go further, one devotee asked Swami Brahmananda, disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, does one need a guru? Without a guru, is it not possible to attain Brahmagnana? And he replied, even if you want to become an expert pickpocket, you need a guru. Do you think in spiritual life you can go forward without a guru? It is an impossibility. The second point you raised is very interesting, because you seem to think the world was a much better world in the past, and now people have become worst. We don't believe in it. How do we know? Okay, I will give two examples. One example is, Sri Krishna himself tells in the Gita, Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschit yatati siddhaye. Yatatamapisiddhanam kaschin maam veti tatvata. Among millions of people, only a few strive to attain me. And of those, large number of those who are striving, only one or two attain me. When did Sri Krishna issue the statement? Day before yesterday? How many years back? So that is clear. And you have to believe what he says, unless you doubt. If you doubt him, then you will doubt me more than him. Okay, the second example is, about 30 to 40 years back, when I was young, I was reading a book on philosophy. I don't remember now what book it was, but what struck me, I still remember. The author started, you know, a description. Nowadays, people are very bad, especially young people. Young boys are running after young girls. Young girls are even running after young boys. They disrespect their elders, and they smoke, they take liquor, they utter, swear all sorts of rotten words. Etc. It went on for 4 or 5 pages. I was wonderstruck. What an accurate description of today's youth. At the end he says, this was what such and such a man had written 2500 years back about the youth of his times. What does that show? That shows the world has not changed a bit. Circumstances have changed, but the mind hasn't changed. So, it is, in those days TV was not there, it is very true. But gambling was there. How do you think the Pandavas were, you know, sent to the forest? What do you think they have done? Tell me, who was to be blamed? If Yudhishthira had not gambled, he would not have been in that position. Why blame Duryodhana? No, you have a choice. You can accept, you can reject. But why did you accept? It's because of the force, or because you enjoyed it really? You know, I can find fault with these things. Ramayana also. Don't take me too seriously. I'm just putting it in a funny way. And also this is Rama's fate. No, what was it? It's all because of Dasharatha. Dasharatha said, I will give you 2 boons. He told to Kaikeyi, what boons? You are a human being. Are you a god? You can give boons. Suppose Kaikeyi said, I want to fly like a bird. Then Dasharatha would have been able to make her fly like a bird. He gave the promise. 2 boons. And then when the time came, she said, send Rama to the forest. He was not willing to, you know, grant that boon. It was Rama who insisted upon it. You are my father. If you have given a word, that means it is as good as my giving a word. And I am just making fun. The point is, the Mahamaya is the same from the beginning of creation to the end of creation. Only very few people want to attain God. But the answer you are seeking is, if you think you can realize God without a guru, go ahead and try it. Who knows, you may succeed. And if you don't succeed, come back to me. Yeah. You are free. Try it.
Maharaj, I'm a
another question which comes to my mind. When Krishna tells Arjuna to kill his kings, and I mean, he's not killing,
yeah.
I mean, family, he's not killing the real person.
Yes, he can't kill the real one.
Yeah, but in worldly, what should I say, in worldly level, we always think, I'm killing my, if I am killing somebody, I'm thinking that I'm killing somebody I know.
Do you?
I mean.
Do you really do that?
No, I don't do, for it's just a...
I'm seriously questioning you. So, let me give an example.
I won't be able to.
Yes, you have done that already. You know, you killed Saddam Hussein. Do you understand what I am talking about? Of course, you have not personally gone and then killed him. But you have elected a man on your behalf who declared war and went and killed him. Do you even feel bad about it? Have you ever lost one day's sleep? Oh, because of me, Saddam Hussein was killed?
No, because I don't have any feeling or any...
The point I am trying to make is that if we know this person is a very dangerous person, he is a bad person, and unless he is prevented, of course, if you can prevent him through good advice or through imprisonment, if you can through containment, then we can do that. But sometimes it is not possible. The only option left out is to kill that person.
Yeah.
So that is what...
Some cases it's necessary.
That is what I am talking about. That's what exactly Sri Krishna was telling. He is not telling to Arjuna, this is your grandfather, so I want you to kill him. He never told that. You will never get it in the Gita. What was he telling? He was telling they are taking part in an unrighteous war. They are supporting it. It's a wonderful point. So they have come to kill you. If you don't kill them, they will kill you. So Krishna never advocated wars, unnecessary wars. If evil is there, confront it and try to overcome it. Whatever means, if it is necessary, of course you will have to kill.
To protect oneself.
It is not only to protect oneself, which is far easier. Suppose your child is being threatened by some bad man. You are not being threatened. Then what will you do?
I take some steps.
That is what exactly we are talking about. Try to understand the situation in Gita. It can be understood in many ways. One way is, on our day-to-day practical level, our life. Another way is allegorical way. Your own mind, there are good tendencies and there are unspiritual tendencies. There is a fight. In many ways, more ways than one, not only in spiritual ways, even in day-to-day life. Now, supposing a student, if he gets up at 6 o'clock, then he can study better. If he gets up at 8 o'clock, then to that extent he is wasting his time. But there is always a struggle in winter season between his resolve to get up and the quilt which he is putting on. The quilt says, stupid fellow, stay, it is so nice and warm. Is it not? This is the fight. So even on a day-to-day practical level, certain things have to be done. And if we don't do it, we only increase the misery. Nowadays, many stupid politicians, they are not following the right way, they don't punish the criminals. And they don't contain the criminals, in the name of, all in the name of human rights. I think, according to me, if you can transform the man, that's a wonderful thing. If you cannot, who suffers more? The victims or those who commit murder and other things? Who is suffering more?
Innocent
people. So innocent people have no rights. Some people, sometimes they are forced to write. Have we no rights? Only criminals have rights?
Yeah.
You know, a government is behaving ridiculously if it cannot protect its innocent people. The issue is very deep, you know. Ordinary people, we have no power. Politicians, business people have tremendous power. And yet,
they misuse their powers too.
In a way, because ultimately we have elected them. So we have to take part of the responsibility also. There is no other way.
Yeah.
Life is too complex. Even to distinguish right and wrong, it is too complex. But we have to clarify situation for ourselves, try to do our best. That is the whole point. Yoga helps us. Whatever we can do, let us do. What we can't do, let us accept.
Yeah, sometimes it becomes very hard to accept certain things.
True.
That makes us feel.
That is why he is advising. If it is something is out of your control, there is no point in mourning about it. You have to reconcile yourself. You have to accept it yourself. You know, this is what psychiatry is about. I'm not talking about only bad things. Suppose some tragedy happened. So maybe the wife died. And it is very hard for the person to accept it.
Yeah.
But it is an event that had taken place. Sooner or later, the sooner he accepts the fact, the better it is for that person and also for others. Sometimes, you know, we are, no man is an island. So there are people in and around us. By not accepting the fact ourselves, not only are we suffering, we are also causing untold misery to all those connected with us. This is a fact. So Gita's teachings are very, very enlightening in this respect. At least it helps me.
Swamiji?
Yes.
You had said that any action that we take goes through three steps, a sort of something like that. I just need a little clarification. It goes like tamas, rajas and sattvic. So you said one is instinctively we do things, and then the sattvic is the intuitively we do things.
Yeah.
And in the middle, I'm getting mixed up. I don't remember the rajas.
Yeah.
But then how do you give, can you give an example?
Yes, I can give an example. First of all, these words, you know, from tamas to rajas to sattva. From instinct to reason. To intuition. Intuition is the result of, you know, very long time discipline. Okay, here is an example. So, many times we act instinctively. So, what is instinct? When we repeat an action several times, it becomes a habit. When it becomes a habit, we don't consciously think about it. We react automatically. That is called instinct. Okay, here is an example. Supposing somebody has criticized you, and what is a normal person's instinct? You are a normal person. Suppose you are accustomed. As soon as somebody criticizes you, immediately you react, who the hell are you to criticize? Now, there are two aspects to that. One aspect is that maybe the person is right. Maybe the situation demands that he should scold you. You have done something wrong. The other situation is that even if he is right, we are not reacting to his criticism. We are criticism of what we have done and what we should have done. We are reacting emotionally. Why should I be hurt by you? My ego is hurt. It is an ego clash. Many of the problems come not because of the real facts, but because of the ego clash. Who are you to tell me off? I have also a right to tell you off. No, that is, we have developed an instinctive way. We are protecting our ego. Sometimes it is good to protect, but sometimes it is good to accept somebody's criticism is good. So here is this example that I gave you. What should we do? What does a reasonable person do? He thinks. So what is this person criticizing me? Is he thinking of criticizing me, pulling me down, hurting my ego? Or he has a right to criticize because I have not done my best according to the expected things. A teacher criticizes a student. A good teacher always criticizes a student's work. A bad teacher always criticizes the student. Now there is a distinction between these two. So if the student thinks, flies up and says, oh, my teacher always, you always criticize me. I will give you a beautiful instance of it, real instance of it. I was in London. Once a couple came and they were married for more than 30 years. And the husband started, the wife told me, Swamiji, my husband is criticizing. I don't know how to cook. Because yesterday or day before yesterday, the dal I prepared, something had gone wrong. It didn't come properly. He says, I don't know cooking. I always do like that. So the husband was there. I told him, come on, be reasonable. How many years are you married? More than 30 years. Since how long has your wife been cooking? Practically for 30 years. 30 into 365. I didn't have calculator, but you can calculate. Practically every day she was preparing. And then how many times did she cook dal of all these days? Practically every day. And how many times did she really spoil the dal? Statistical evidence. Maybe 50 times. I don't think even 50 times. It may not be. Spoiling is one thing and not up to the taste is another thing again. So maybe 4 or 5 times it has really gone bad. What is the instinctive reaction? Always you cook badly. Is it rational? This is just an example to show many times we react like this. You are always angry with me. We forget how many times they are like, you know, the children complain, you always scold me. How many times the parents really scold the children? Very few times. Nowadays, you know, these children have a right to scold their parents. If the parents scold their children, then they will complain, the social work. Yes. You have the experience, huh?
Not me, but somebody I knew.
I know.
Yes.
I know this. This happened.
A girl who was about 11 years old or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the point is, this is where we should exercise our reason. And reason has these two benefits. Either it is true or it is not true. If criticism is true, then I should gladly accept, because without paying money for a psychiatrist, the person is a wonderful thing, you know, about criticism. Anyway, just take 2 minutes time. There was a great soul called Vidyaranya. And we all suffer from criticism. Either self-criticism or others' criticism. Anyway, he said, if somebody criticizes you, there are 3 ways you can respond. All positive ways. First, stop. Is it true what he is telling? Then thank him, because without paying hundreds of dollars to the psychiatrist, he is doing the greatest service. He is telling you what the psychiatrist will tell you after paying money. Correct yourself. He is your greatest well-wisher. First. Second, suppose whatever he said is absolutely nonsense. There is no truth in it. But he is strengthening your capacity to bear and forbear. And what a marvelous thing it is. And therefore thank him as your greatest benefactor. Because if you can bear this, in course of time, nothing will touch you. The third is a very beautiful thing. He says third. In this world, to give happiness to others, you have to spend lot of money and energy. But here you are giving the greatest happiness to the other person without spending a single penny of your own, just by allowing yourself to be criticized. What a marvelous thing you are doing. So, reason, we are not reasonable creatures. If we really reason, you know, this first principle I told, either something is real or it is not real. And instinctive people will not understand it. Only rational people will understand. If it is true, it is true. If it is not true, it is not true. That helps us. I know, we are not that kind of people. Just okay, if it happens, happens. It doesn't happen, doesn't happen. Why worry? We have not reached that state. But it helps us. Reduce a little bit. Is it not? Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Okay.